Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
You're listening to Griefcast with me, Carrie Adloyd. How do we grieve for someone? How does it change and evolve as we get older? My dad died when I was 15, and it took me many, many years to be able to express what I had gone through. So I decided to create Griefcast, a chance to talk, share and laugh about the weirdness of grief and death. But with comedians, so it's not that depressing, I promise. Each time I talk to a different comedian about their own personal experience of grief, as we remember someone that they have lost along the way. Whether it was a long time ago or you've just joined the club, this is a chance to talk about the peculiar human process of death. Welcome to Griefcast.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
Hey Griefsters, I hope you're having an okay week. I'm exhausted, I'm not going to lie. It's these nights, isn't it? It's dark so early, makes you tired. Oh, and being pregnant and various other things as well. Thank you so much for listening as ever. If you enjoy the show, you know what I'm going to say. Please do rate and review and subscribe. That really helps. If you've done so already, thank you so much. And just tell people if you think you know someone who it might help or someone who might be interested, who's brave enough to think and talk about death, please do spread the word because it makes such a huge difference. Just a heads up, this is going to be our last sort of one-on-one interview, and then we're going to do now that's what I call Griefcast, like we did last year, our best of. So do tweet me if you have a clip that you want to hear again or you want to share with other people because it really moved you or made you laugh, and we will be doing the best of shows coming up soon. This week I'm talking to what is for me a comedy legend, Mr. Mike McShane. You may know Mike from Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, or Office Space, or he's been in Frasier, he's been in Seinfeld. But I have a huge crush on that man for being in the improvised comedy show Whose Line's It Anyway, which inspired me to become an improviser. So I was so grateful that he decided to come and talk to me. Mike came to talk to me about all the griefs he's experienced along the way in his life, but also more specifically about his mum, Ruby. Welcome to Griefcast. I'm here today with actor, improviser and theatre lover Mike McShane, who told me to say that, because it's true.
Ah, yes, but does she love me back now?
She loves you back.
She certainly loves me back, better than I deserve, man.
Oh, Mike, it's such a joy to have you here. I'm very excited.
A double happiness for me.
Lots of people will know you from the many, many things you've done over the years. Office Space, Robin Hood, probably like the really massive ones, aren't they? But I know you anyway, but from Whose Line's It Anyway? The seminal improvisation show that ran in this country, I can't remember how long for. It's still going in America, right?
It still goes in America. It's on like the WB or one of the side channels. We started in 88, I think.
Wow.
I did it till 95 here. I didn't do the American version. So 88, I was in the last show of the first series. I remember that. It was over.
Yeah, because the first series, sorry, I'm such a geek about Who's Line, but the first series was very sort of serious, and like Jonathan Pryce was doing it, and John Sessions, and it was sort of more parlor games than improv.
Right.
And then by the second series, the Americans joined, and it got a bit more like comedy.
Well, I think what happened, I can't remember, maybe it was Jimmy Mulville that said that they started picking up on using us because physically Americans, this is them, met in the middle totally, and were physically more free.
Yeah,
and they were moving to camera, so that's what they wanted. Because Robin and all that kind of stuff, Robin Williams, it was that is American improv. You know?
Yeah, because there was a lot, the first series is great in its own way, but it's lots of sort of men standing still.
And being adroit and witty.
Yeah, very witty, witty, but slightly sort of 1950s BBC radio show, I guess, of like not really moving. You're right, actually, then when you and Greg and Ryan and Colin come, like it starts getting more physical. Oh my God, I loved that show so hard. I mean, that's why I do impro, is that show.
Did you tape it at all?
We used to tape it on Friday night. Sometimes we would stay up, but sometimes I don't think we were allowed. So we'd tape it on Friday night and then we'd watch it on Saturday. And we'd also watch, I don't know why we were taping it, but we'd watch Gladiators, you know, the fighting.
Right.
Yeah, like, so we'd watch Who's Line and Gladiators.
Kind of excitement of sorts.
It was like, me and my brother were like, this is great Saturday morning. We get to watch Who's Line and Gladiator. Very happy. And because you could tape things. So, and I still remember your, the one that really sticks in my head with you is the duet you did with Josie, the cat litter. Yeah, that still sticks in my head.
I had a kick doing that. I like doing the American Tourister song. I remember that one.
Oh, what was that one?
Well, anything Richard. Richard was the first thing. He really hit a really different, something that came out, he hit a really different song style. And I was like, oh, and I responded to it. And, you know, the fun thing is when somebody gives you something really different and you're on it and you hit it right.
Yeah.
And then you're together, you know. So this is great. You can talk to Carrie about this in a weird shorthand.
And yeah, I know what you're talking
about.
Because
she's like superior in so many ways as an improviser.
No, not you.
I've known these guys for a long time. For me, watching them grab this thing, and turn it into what I think a lot of us enjoy without getting too poncy about it, an art form.
Yeah.
Just like opera or ballet. You know, you apply this to anything.
But we were very led by, you know, your generation, especially you, because I remember we were in Edinburgh and you came and did our show when me and Paul Foxcroft were like impro babies, and we asked you to come and do a late night show at Sea Venues, and you came and we did, there was a Shakespeare scene and everyone else was doing like real gags for the crowd and you did a Shakespeare scene. I remember sitting at the side thinking, oh, I see, you can always treat it with respect, like, you know what I mean? I was like, you don't have to play to this crowd of drunk people at 3 a.m, like you can just still do your show, and you were so good. And I was like, oh, wow. Because also, that was the first time I saw you, like, on set as opposed to on my television. Well, it's such an honour to have you. And I mean, I could talk to you about improv for an hour, but that's another podcast.
Let's do that some other time and have lunch.
yeah, exactly. So who are we remembering today, Mike?
We're remembering my first experience with somebody I'd met in a way and then seeing them dead. And then my mother.
Right.
And by way of explanation, I'm adopted.
Mm.
So I'm adopted. My mother, Mary Catherine Lewis, who bore me and gave me up at 3 weeks old, was Irish and Métis, French-Canadian Chippewa. And my dad was ship of the night, and or sperm donor, as I like to call him.
Yeah.
And he did his job and left. And I was born David Lewis for 3 weeks. And the McShanes, my mother, Ruby Stafford McShane, was born in 1912. My father, Kenneth John McShane, born in 1910, adopted me and took me from Sault Ste. Marie, Michigan. I was one of six other children, all born to different fathers, who lived in the Upper Peninsula. People who live up there are known as Youpers. And it can be rough place. I mean, rough in the environment, physical environment's rough. And I wouldn't have had a lot of shots. So starting from there, I'm really grateful that the McShanes were my parents.
So Ruby McShane is who we're going to talk about.
Ruby McShane is my mother.
I love that name. That's a great name.
I call Mary Catherine Lewis my blood mother.
Yeah.
You know, and Ruby McShane is my mother.
Yeah. So who was your first experience?
Father Condon. He was an Irish priest. I went to St. Agnes grade school. I went to Catholic grade school. And first grade, I went to kindergarten there too. And between kindergarten and first grade, I had a huge growth spurt. I got big. And
what's kindergarten, first grade for us?
Kindergarten is when you're 5 years old. It's like not preschool.
Okay.
So it kind of give you some room. Basically, you run around with toys and, you know.
Yeah, reception, I think that's what
we call it. Reception. Yeah. So, but then, six, then you start
right.
your curriculum.
Okay. You know. Yeah.
And so I walked into first grade and everybody was much smaller than me.
Wow.
And since I was a little middle class bastard, I went, my God, I flunked kindergarten. How could that have happened? You know, and they were. I was really distraught. The nun went, no. This is you're just a big boy.
You're just bigger, yeah.
And I sat down, and then we had our first one of the talks about first communion, and how to handle the host. And Father Condon, who looked like George Burns, an old comedian, white hair, sort of smiley, white face, sort of like the old man in Up. If you mention the old man in Up,
yeah,
with an Irish dialect. So forgive me, Irish. national people who live in Ireland, if you hear this, it's approximately. So he came in, and he's very old school. I was like, I'm going to talk to you about communion. Now, there was a boy named John, and he took the host in his mouth and then went back to his house, and he didn't swallow it. What he did is he took it out of his mouth, and he cut it with a knife. Suddenly, great gouts of blood came out of the host. I mean, gushing out. He couldn't stop it. He tried to put it back together. There was so much blood coming out of it that, you know, he didn't know what to do. He was up to his ankles and bloody. Funny, smartly, you know, he called a priest. And the priest came over, made the sign of the cross, and all the blood, like the party of the Red Sea in reverse, went back into the host, sealed it up. He put it in his mouth and swallowed it, and he was fine. Never cut the consecrated host.
He told a room full of six-year-olds that happened.
We were all like, and literally finished and went, oh, bless you, chill, have a good day. And walked out, and we're like,
what? Oh, my God.
Dude, it was a trip. Cut to 6 months later, he dies.
Oh, my God. You must be terrified of this immediately. Like, yeah.
We're all going, did he cut the host? We thought of that. I used to have this image later of the idea of, like, in Catholic hospitals, they have, like, a host in like, a glass box in case somebody has a blood transfusion. They just kick it and, like, cut it open. There we go. No.
Oh, my
God. Put the
host
over their veins. You know, just so he's in the coffin, all waxy and stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
And they're walking us by. We're at, like, an exhibit at the British Museum, you know, looking at Tutankhamun or something. And we're looking at him. And then they go, you can kiss him if you want.
Wow.
I like shot a look, but then I'm like, you gotta be fucking kidding me.
Like, why?
Well, yeah, yeah.
Why
yeah.
do
and
I want
to? And of course, a couple of, you know, this is Catholicism. Every third or fourth kiss, like,
okay.
You're like.
So you didn't kiss him?
No.
Good for you. Good for you. I think that's a sign of a good child. If at six, you're like, that's weird.
Yes.
Because some kids, like you say, are like, okay, I've been told and brought up that I have to do everything that I'm
told.
Well,
I definitely wanted to be loved by the church, but yeah. I ain't kissing no dead priests, you know. So that was my first experience. And there was a kid who had water on the brain, but he was gone like the second week.
Wow.
And he said he was gone. So that was kind of, and my dad grew up in 1910 during the diphtheria epidemic.
Wow.
And he would go to school and like every other day be another kid out of his class. And he at one point just goes, When's my number up?
Wow.
Know? Yeah. He was up in Minnesota. So
did they talk about did they explain to you about the priest? Or they just said, he's gone to heaven, that's the end of it?
Yeah. It was a mass. You know, you kind of figure, once you're, you know, brought into the Catholic Church and all the ritual stuff, you know, all these things are about somebody lived a good life and are ascending to heaven, and their woes are over.
Yeah.
Especially the very Irish side of it. There's a lot of, like, you know.
Yeah.
The pain of life is gone.
Yeah, yeah.
So you kind of get some of that. I'm an actor. I dug the smells of those.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The drag looked good, you know. The sound sounded good. I memorized the mass in Latin. I got in trouble once. This kid named Kirk Kippy was sitting next to me. I was like, don't even this coming, come through. And it hugged down. You know, I'm doing it. And he's like, hey, what are you saying? What? Sister, these kids talking the devil's language. And like, Sister Immaculata comes over. She goes, what's he doing? Oh, he's being a good boy. And she like whacked Kirk Tippy in the face, like, you know, off the top of the head. Boom, gave one of those. Like, you should be able to do that, kind of. And of course, like, the next day in school, it's like, fat boy come out here. Oh, no, Kurt, you know, we're like chasing these. Anyway.
Kurt, what was his name?
Kirk Kippy.
Oh, my God, Mike.
This two P's and an E. Kirk Kippy.
Kirk Kippy is the Kippy. Such a good name. I also love that.
He's one of those guys like Marcus Brigstock has a slightly, but yeah, handsome Marcus, but that slightly cylindrical head thing going, you know, and he had like this weird haircut. So he just, I've got going, you look like a jar of peanut butter, you know?
Kirk Kippy. Kippy sounds like a peanut butter.
Skippy.
Well.
I don't think Kippy is Skippy. Yeah. I used to think.
Wow, I love it that you live in that. Well, you lived in that age where it was just like, yeah. Then a nun whacked him in the face, and that was just like normal school. Like,
Carrie, I swear, my Catholic, the Midwestern Catholic nuns were hardcore.
Yeah,
there was one named Sister Lucille. my best friend, who'd been my best friend since I've been five and is still my best friend, Tommy Mica, his dad was a huge Catholic, big Polish Catholic, you know, 12 kids.
Wow.
I mean, 12 kids. I was 13. I literally was a kid who would hang out with him. His dad, Mr. Mica, would go to Medjugorje and carry a cross, like, you know, this
carrying cross.
My dad, who was Catholic, was like, okay, you know, I'm a Catholic, but whoa, I'm not going that way. Phew, woo. You know, he really goes, like, not that much. So when he died, it was a big deal. And so, you know, I was a pallbearer because he was my godfather.
Yeah.
Mr. Mica was my dad was Tommy's godfather. Anyway, so we're there, you know, it's sort of the reception line for a dead person, which is always really weird. Hello, yes, he's dead. Yeah. Hi, you know, people are important in his life. And this nun comes up and, like, looks at me and shakes my hand. I had a dead zone moment. I went, I know you. I was like Sister Lucille, but hang. And when I was like 6 or 7, I was out, just wandering out in the hallway. I came up, I have a bathroom. So out in the hallway. And she's come down. She had crutches because she had polio or something. Couldn't use her legs well. So coming down with these crutches. And this other kid came out of the bathroom who we would call then Greaser, which this guy looks like from Grease, the movie Grease, with the pompadour, ducktail, that kind of stuff. He was coming out of the bathroom, and he walked by her kind of like against the locker room, boom, and like stopped him with a crutch and got up and says, going, you've been smoking cigarettes. And in one, I can't remember, like a kung fu move, spun him around, pinned him against the lockers.
With the crutch.
And with the other crutch, just wailed on the back of his fucking legs.
Oh, my God.
And so I'm watching this guy who looks like a tough guy. In my mind, it's a tough guy going, yeah! You know, he's screaming and crying. Oh, and he goes hobbling off. And then she comes down the hall past me and goes, God bless you, son. You're just like, again, ha. So it's a very strange world.
Wow, that is intense. That's really intense.
Which culminated me going to a seminary when I was... I wanted to be a priest.
God.
I was making good on my dad. Made my dad very proud of the people. They got kicked out.
Okay.
It was fine. Yeah. So my mama.
So your mom, Ruby.
My mom, Ruby Stafford McShane, was born in 1912, October 7th, 1912. She's from Belleville, Kansas, but really Scandia, a small town in northern Kansas on the Nebraska border. One of, I have to look them up because it was kind of, Marjorie Rosalind, Gwendolyn and Betty, who died earlier in life, and Dale, the only boy, the youngest. My mother was a petite, small, dark-eyed woman. She grew up literally in a sod hut. She was born in a sod hut.
What's sod hut? What
a sod hut is made out of earth, stacked like a peat building. They'd bought land and were building the house, and there was some of the Dust Bowl activity, not the main one, but slowed them down.
Yeah,
so they built a berm, like a sod hut, and lived in it for 6 years and then built a house.
Wow.
My pictures of her, I have a picture of her when she's about 15, and she's taken her dad's hat and cut the brim off it to look like a flapper hat and cut her hair like Louise Brooks.
Yeah, yeah.
And she's from the side, and she looks very sad. So you'll have to excuse me if I get emotional sometimes.
That's all right.
My first memory as a child was walking alongside of her, and she had these capri pants on and a striped top, black and white striped top of the time. Very Mary Tyler Moore looking, that hair, and very red lips. And we had black walnuts, which would go up and down the street. You could, which is a very tough-shelled walnut, but extremely flavorful. In fact, almost too much. Not really good for eating, but baking. And she would take a baseball bat and hit the trees, and I'd collect the nuts and drag them around. And I remember holding her hand looking up at her. She was a great mommy. She was a sparkling beauty. Now, from here on to a degree, anything positive in my mother's life will be a memory related to me by my dad to a degree. She chain smoked. So about, 10, 11, 12, she was just, she raised me with a lot of trepidation being adopted. She had a social worker that had to come all the time. And so when they were coming, I was literally I was on call for a West End show. It's scrubbed up, cleaned up, nice clothes. And they took care of me. They treated me. I'm spoiled. You know, I was.
And were you the only child?
I was the only child. So I was adopted and the only child.
And
so
when did they tell you right from the start that you were adopted?
A little later, they told me I was adopted when I was about 4 or 5. I was an orphan. My mom said I was an orphan, then I was adopted. And so I saw orphan. And this is the truth. Week or two after that, a Saturday morning movie was David Lean's Oliver Twist.
Oh, wow.
And I watched that and I went, I'm an orphan. I'm like them.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I went and rubbed dirt all over my face, rolled my pant legs up, and went up to the Thriftway store in the shopping center and stood in front of the door and begged for money, trying to cop a really phony ass cocky until they called and go, Mrs. McShane, your boy's out here talking weird, trying to get money. And she drove up. She's like, land sakes, Mike, what are you doing? And I'm like, she goes, oh, okay, all right, all right. Oh, she got it.
Yeah, yeah.
She got back in the car. My mom stuck in the door. I'll tell you, my mom stuck up for me.
And she was like, you are an orphan, but you're not.
You're an orphan, but then.
You're
but
not a Victorian like, Cockney orphan.
Like, how much you make? I was like, oh, made a buck. She goes, I put it in the piggy bank. Didn't make me give it back.
Yeah, so your childhood was very happy then, like, essentially.
Yeah, I got teased a bit. Yeah. I made my, to a large degree, I realized I made my childhood a little tougher than it was. Also, I was extremely gullible and imaginative. So people could take advantage of that when I was young. I had country cousins, my Uncle Dale's kids, who would, like, I'd go up there. It was just like, you know, I was like one of those things, you know, you saw me, you saw them look at me, then you saw them what they saw. And it was just like a toy and baseball bats around the head, you know. And the one guy held me down, Roger held me down once. And they had these plants, like cattails. There's fluffy seeds. Fluffy wing, you know, seedlings in them. And I wanted those. And he goes, those are ghost plants. I went, ghost plants? I was, yeah. You know, if you get them on your skin, they burrow and then ghosts come out of your back at night. And literally after they said that, they held me down, stripped my shirt off, and rubbed the plant all over my back. So I'm screaming. And I go back to my grandma, Florence, and she's like, what'd they do? And she's like, oh, God, that was no ghost plants. Go upstairs, go to bed. And then later I heard her giving them holy hell about it. She loved me because I think she wanted my mom to have a child.
Yeah.
My mom was a slightly melancholy woman all of her life. The picture of her with the Louise Brooks haircut, her eyes are really sad. And, you know, she had to take care of her grandparents who were just flinty, awful Methodists on the Nebraska border. And the only escape in life, she could slide down the drain pipe with skates around her neck and go roller skating in Chester, Nebraska, at the Chester Rollatorium, which she told me about with much glee.
So she had quite a tough upbringing then.
Controlled, not, you know, it was rough, you know, I think. Yeah, I mean.
Well, I guess it's just tough for the time. The time
tough
was tough.
For the time, yeah, yeah. You know? Yeah.
You didn't have all mod cons and it wasn't easy.
She took the path that most women did. Yeah. You were either teachers or a nurse.
Yeah.
So most of the women in the family became nurses, except my Aunt Gwendolyn, who became a teacher. So my Aunt Marjorie, my Aunt Rosalind, my mom, Betty died much later in life. My Aunt Rosalind married a doctor, Doc Splickall, and my Aunt Betty, who I never met, came down with appendicitis. And they were poor. My mom's family was poor, and they couldn't afford a doctor. And they said, we got one in the family. But Dr. Splickall was a pill doctor, as they say, not a cutting doctor, as we say in the Midwest. And he kind of was forced into doing it, and he botched the operation, and she died.
Oh, my God.
I didn't know about this until I was much, much older.
Wow.
Because I had a picture of the family. I'd ask about Betty. And my mom goes, oh, no, she's gone somewhere. We see her once in a while. And
that's that. Oh, my God. So when did your mom die? When did she pass?
She died in 85.
85, okay. So were you still living in America then?
I was, and Whose Line was on top of that. And I was enjoying, I just moved to California. And she passed. It was in the hospital. So when I was 14 years old, my mother and my dad and I were in a car accident. My mother was driving.
Okay.
We were having a family argument in my car. My mother was distracted, and we were T-boned by a car, which means we were driving.
Yeah.
So the car came at the panel on her side.
Wow.
Which threw my dad into me and threw her, and this was an older car, no seatbelts. My mother's neck snapped slightly, and they had to operate on her neck, and they botched the operation. So my mother had a frozen neck and radial arm damage on her left arm, and she spent then the rest of her life in a neck brace and an arm brace eating Darvon, which is an analgesic with codeine in it.
Wow.
The Darvon was this pill, like a regular, you know, capsule, and inside was a tiny red codeine, liquid codeine. And as a teenager, I used to take them out and eat them. So you see where this is going.
Yeah, sure. So that obviously hugely affected.
Yeah, it did. It started me being a very reactionary, angry person which I'm not proud of. I mean,
yeah, but so how old were you? You were 14?
14.
Well, I mean, you're dead. You know, it's like we say in the show, my dad was 15. Sorry, was 15 when my dad died. And
you know what I'm saying, yeah?
Yeah, when shit happens at that age, like, you get really angry because you're already angry. Yeah. You know, as a teenager, you're already like, oh, the world's rubbish. No one understands me. And then when something real happens, you're like, oh, I've got a reason to be this angry.
Yeah.
Because I think most teenagers are like, oh, I don't, you know, I'm angry, but there's no real reason. And I'm just frustrated and I don't know who I am. But when you're given a reason as a teenager, I think it becomes quite potent because you're like, oh, there's the evidence of why I'm so fucking angry. Like right there. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. You get like fate or whatever, whatever you're processing and goes, here you go. Here's a big plate of shit.
Yeah.
Yeah. You want to, it gives you, that does give you a focus.
Yeah.
Yeah, I reacted pretty badly to it. But first, first step was there was a guy who had some weird competition with me named David Schwartz. He didn't like me because his dad was in the Marines. But he always picked on me and stuff because my best friend Tommy, he wanted to be his best friend. That wasn't happening. And I came back. I was like out of school for like 2 weeks, maybe, healing up a little. And I came back and he was like kind of getting in my kitchen about stuff. And he goes, so where you been, Trunco? That was my nickname because I was fat. Because I was an elephant. So they call me Trunco, which is a great, you know, the
kids.
Talent in this school.
Yeah,
St.
Yeah.
Agnes, the talent in St. Agnes. It's like the Algonquin round table with Eucharist hosts. He said, I said, leave me alone. My mom's in the hospital. We had a car wreck. And Eddie just had the temerity to go, I hope your mother dies.
Whoa.
And I just went, wing, and Tommy said, I just grabbed him and threw him to the ground, started punching him in the head, picked him up by the neck, running him into the desks as I walked towards the third story window of our classroom,
Ooh.
Opened it up and started to take him out the window.
Oh
and the nuns and everybody like, boom, and I just, dissolved.
Yeah, because you were probably really, really sad and shocked and you had nowhere to put that emotion because of the time. And actually what you wanted to do is go, oh, this is horrible. What's just happened? I'm really sad.
Well, I'm a guy. That's how guys react, right? I mean, Karen says, kind of the rule she believes, and that's absolutely true, is like men only process all things by getting angry.
Mm.
And women can have every emotional world but anger.
Yeah, I think it depends because I definitely got angry. Like that was because I didn't want to cry. So I was so obsessed with not crying because I suppose I thought if I start crying, I don't know if I'm going to stop. So when teachers were like, so is everything all right? I'd be like, yeah, everything's fucking all right. What the fuck's wrong with you? Like, I was just like,
wow.
Boom. Because I was like, if I do that, they'd go, okay, leave her alone. And I was like, oh, phew, I'm not going to cry.
You're not going to have to deal with these people asking you how you are.
Yeah, because you know you're not okay, really. Yeah, but you don't really want to.
Did you hang with friends and let it out?
No.
Oh,
I guess I did. And it became the thing of like, she's angry. Oh, she's just really, she's really aggressive and angry and just leave her to it. And I'd get into trouble at school and, but it started that vicious circle. It became like, she's a problem. And then everyone, I think, slightly forgot, oh, her dad's died. Because it was like, you've got to calm down. You can't be out like this in school. You could, get out of the classroom. And then it all became about my attitude. And no one was talking about my dad.
The source point.
Yeah, which was great. I didn't want to talk about my dad. I was like, thank God. So they were like, get out of the classroom. And I was yep, great.
Did it help? I mean, the slightly, forgive me speaking generally, that slightly British thing of like, get on with it a bit. But that wasn't it. It was like, you were just, leave me alone. I don't want to process it in front of you.
Yeah, I think I was just so afraid because I just didn't understand what happened. I didn't understand. And so, my dad was diagnosed in February, dead by the April. So it was very quick.
Oh, Lord. Okay.
Yeah, so it's very quick. So I think I was like you said, in shock, scared,
there
afraid.
There wasn't a long thing, anything. So
there was no time to be like, oh, okay, this is happening. So my anger was such a great, it was very successful in that it did what I wanted it to do, which was it just meant I never spoke about what was actually going on because I didn't know how to. I saw what I wanted to say was like, what the fuck? Sorry, can someone just tell me what just happened? I feel awful. I'm really, really sad. But I was so afraid of that because I thought, I don't know if it was wrong or I don't know what I thought. I don't know. I just was afraid.
You're afraid what's going to happen if you
let
it all in.
Exactly. If I just start crying, I won't stop.
You won't stop. And
so I was just like, be angry. And I just learned really quickly, if you're angry, they just leave you alone. They don't want to talk to you anymore because you're this teenager who's shouting at them or being like, oh, I don't want to fucking talk about it. And, they just go, okay, fine. Like,
Well, wow, I met you on the upswing.
Yeah, you did.
Pal.
You definitely did.
You must
have
been. Wow.
Yeah. I know people always think, they're like, you were angry. I'm like, whereas people who knew me then are like, are you kidding?
No.
Yeah, so you were very angry, I guess, and trying to deal with it.
I was very angry. And that anger, Also, I was large and ungainly. I mind that. I was angry. The time in the 70s, there was the counterculture, which I wanted to embrace. I wanted to be a hippie. I wanted this thing in Kansas in the 60s and 70s. That wasn't going to happen. And it made me even more angry. And I got into drugs, and I got into a bit of thieving, robbing, like, houses and cars and shit. So I became very antisocial. I got in with a crowd not so great. But I was also just reveling in being a not being the soft, fat, gullible kid.
Yeah.
So that kind of uncorked me. And in that time, I would get into arguments with my parents. And then I got violent. I held my dad up against the wall with a knife. I inadvertently stabbed my mother with a pair of scissors. I threw a pair of scissors and it stuck in her leg. And during this time, before this incident, we were going to counselors and psychiatrists. To be fair, my parents were of a different time. I was a product of a different time. My responsibility that I look at now and know where I was responsible. It was a big mess. They ran out of money and they panicked. And so they put me in a mental hospital, made me a ward of the state of Kansas. And I was just around 13 or 14. And 7 months I spent there.
Is this before the accident or after the accident?
This is after the accident.
So they put you in the mental hospital after the accident. They must have just all been, we were all reeling from this accident,
right? All worn out. This was after, but a couple of years after, really, a year and a half or so. I didn't, when I look back, it went bad faster than I imagined it.
Yeah.
So when I went in there was about a year and a half of going to different doctors, and they didn't have a lot of money. The bills, the lawyers were moms.
Yeah.
I look back and with a lot of shame, realizing if I would just not been such a selfish person, I could have seen what they were going through.
But when you're young, you don't know. Yeah, you don't know.
You don't know.
And they probably don't tell you. Like, there's not that, you know, I think as a kid, you're often like, oh, why didn't I do that? And you're like, but parents are equally trying to protect you, and you, so then you are protected from that information.
They're trying to fix me.
Yeah, yeah.
In their mind, they're trying to, you know.
Something's wrong, and we can find it, and then switch it off, and it's done. Yeah.
Which consisted of, because my mom took drugs. She was a nurse. The pharmacopoeia of the world was very much in her concept, and so she thought this place could pill it out of me and session counsel it out of me. And what she didn't know, it was a battery of different drugs, threats of shock treatment, attempted rape on me. It was kind of weird. So that 7 months was very hellish. And the drug treatment in the beginning, I did 1 week in another hospital to test what I needed. And that was in Kansas City. This other place was in Osawatomie, which is in the country. And Osawatomie to the Midwesterner is like saying to a London person, Bedlam.
Right, okay.
It's a shorthand. You got free tobacco. That was the good thing about Osawatomie. The state of Kansas decided the adolescent unit could have as much tobacco as it wanted.
It just gave you cigarettes.
Yeah. Well, not cigarettes. You'd get this loose tobacco and you could roll your own. Or there's a guy there who was total Ozark kid. I mean, maybe he was 14 with a full beard. And as God's truth, carried the overalls with the strap off. And he was like, not very bright. And he had a cigarette rolling machine. He had this big, it's a big canvas belt with a loop. And you put the...
They sell them in Camden Mall.
Imagine a big version of that. Wow. He would just knock them out for a penny a throw. And so you give him 5 cents, you give five cigarettes. And he had a corncob pipe. And he would stuff it. And you can't have matches there. So you go to the AIDS booth and knock on the door. And they had a spun asbestos plate in the wall behind a curled cord.
Oh, my heating God. Element.
And so he light your cigarette there. And when he light his pipe, you just see this guy with a huge plume of smoke coming out. I just remember watching him going. And you're all drugged up on Thorazine or Valium or whatever they're giving you at that time. Heavy Thorazine, if you acted up, I got put in solitary. They just stick it in your ass and you're out for 4 days. And you have to pee really bad. So after that, life was weird. I got out. I had the scarlet A on my head. I went to a regular school, state school. I mean, a public school, we call it. And when I was 18, I joined the Army.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Welcome back to Griefcast with Carrie Adloyd.
So in that time, things happen. In that time, my mother's health deteriorated from the smoking and the pills. You know, she became thinner and thinner. She was a petite woman to begin with. She had insomnia. I remember that was bad when I was a kid. And that's because my mom met my dad in Kansas. My dad was a quartermaster in the Army, and he was in charge of being the quartermaster of a prisoner of war camp in Kansas, in Concordia, which held Rommel's Africa Corps. Not Rommel himself, because he was such a prize he stayed in Europe, but Rommel's Africa Corps and the officers were there. And she was a nurse. And
wow.
So she met my dad there. And during that time, she had to cut down a German soldier who had been hung by the officers and try to resuscitate him, and didn't work. She was the night nurse at the station, and the nurse came screaming down the hallway that somebody had been hung, and the guy had been strapped up with a belt and hung from a pipe. And she cut him down. So she'd have nightmares about it. So when I was a kid, she'd be in her big, just like peach-colored, frilly neck, chain-smoking a cigarette with the collar on, sitting in the hall in their chair. And I'm going, and she goes, "That's all right, honey." And, you know, having that dream again. But that man, and he's rechaining, and I go back to bed. I picked up the smoking habit from my mom.
Yeah. I mean, it's
hard
not to, right?
We'd and stuff and argues. We'd actually have smoke breaks.
Yeah.
Like, you know. And.
Well, maybe that helped. Occasionally, you have 2 seconds. So, yeah, so her health had really deteriorated from that point
on. And she was, a bit dotty and paranoid. And my dad kind of kept a lot of it from me because I didn't live in Kansas anymore. I moved around to California. They still gave me money and supported me when I needed it, and they weren't doing great. Not a fixed income. My dad had 2 pensions. And they had investments, and they're very smart. They're that generation that kind of floated by on that. We lived in a 3-bedroom house, which the rooms were not much bigger than the room we're in. The kitchen and living room was at. So it was a post-war prefab house. And the world got smaller. They started to hoard. They're of the generation, they embarrassed my little middle-class sensibilities anyway. They were growing in the Depression.
Mm.
So we'd go to eat. My mom would take ketchup packets and stuff like that. I'd be like, "Oh, my God, Mother. Oh, Lord." I'd be like, "Oh, just so stupid." Personally, it was. So anyway, I got a call from Dad saying she's not good. Said she has cancer.
So when is this? This is when you're living in...
This is 1995. I just moved back.
So you're in San Francisco at this point?
No, I'd moved to L.A.
I moved to L.A. So you're in L.A. You've done Who's Line? So your career is going very well.
Going
at this
well.
Point.
Starting to get stuff on TV in America. And I get the call, and so... Well, I get the call before America, because both Karen and I knew Mom wasn't doing well, because when I was in San Francisco, she had dementia from this, of creeping, but it got worse. And Dad, it was worse than I thought it was, because my dad kept it from me.
Yeah.
She came to see me. I was in a theater company in San Francisco called ACT, which was a very big company, American Conservatory Theater, Tony Award-winning theater company. A lot of actors you see on American TV came from there. Anyway, I was a big fish in a small pond there. I was in Forum. I did finally get one of the Forum. It was a big production. Everybody loved it. And my mom and dad finally came to see me be on stage.
Is that the first time they saw you?
My dad actually saw me in Macbeth in college, and
wow.
He fell asleep. He fell asleep. He goes, "There's a lot of talking there. Got pretty snappy at the end with the swords." I went, "That's the best critic. Thank you. Critic's choice.
Yeah, that's it."
Ken McShane says, "Got snappy at the end there with the swords."
That's a good review of Macbeth.
Yeah,
to be
come on. If you're a guy, that tells you everything you need to know.
Yeah.
They really tried to come along. My mom said, "Let's go see theater. Mike wants to do theater early on." So they went to like a dinner theater to see on Golden Pond, and it was like the World Series with the Kansas City Royals. And my dad was like, "What the fuck?" And he said, "No, how we're going to go. So he had the radio, like, listening to it. So during this, like, you know, I love you, Pa. Oh, damn. He was literally doing that kind of thing. Totally. You know, and my mom said, and my dad was like, oh, shit. Watching a bunch of old fucking people talk about fucking dying. Who wants to go see that shit? You know, my mom was like, mm-hmm. Yeah,
with the World Series is on, fair play. So they came to see you in San Francisco.
And so I said, Mom, you're in San Francisco. Let's go look at places. She's like, no, I don't feel like going out. And she just sat in the hotel room and smoked.
Wow, yeah.
I realized she was scared. Oh. She was enough to admit, she was like, where am I?
Yeah.
Because I could see the look on her face when I went. So we're turning around and go, are you sure? And she's like, you know, and I was like, I just was like, something's wrong. But you're so stupid. I didn't go. What's going on, Dad?
But don't you think it's like you don't want to ask the question sometimes? I think sometimes as a child, you know, however
old
you are.
I'm an adult then.
But you're still a child in that dynamic.
Yeah.
However old you are. I think sometimes you know, but you don't say because you don't want the answer. I definitely had moments of that when I think, I'm not going to ask. I should ask. But if I walk away, I don't know. But I do know. Like, and I guess everybody, you all know.
You do, yeah.
But just saying it out loud sometimes is really frightening. Because, you know, and perhaps you didn't want to frighten them, you know. And
yeah,
have them...
my dad's a generation of a guy who didn't broach things until they were. Yeah. I think we need to have that talk.
Yeah, you know? Yeah.
Everything else was never. You know.
Yeah. So you get called that she's got cancer. Where does she have
cancer? She fell. She kept falling. And then she fell and didn't get up.
Oh, God.
Now, some dad called me. So I went to see her. It was snowing. And I went there, and she was kind of like out. She's kind of out.
And this is back in Kansas?
Kansas.
Right, yeah.
So it's about 3 days. And body was riddled with cancer. I remember at one point going, do you want to go, Mama? Do you want to go? And she was like, no. She was like, no. I was like, all right. We stayed there 3 or 4 days, and this is a weird showbiz thing. So the show had a popularity in America, fine. Like on Comedy Central and shit like that. So I'm there with my dad, and somebody recognized me. Some kid recognized me and told his dad, a guy maybe a little older than me, that I was a famous factory guy or something, or comedic guy. And this guy's at the hospital, too. So a guy walks over to me and goes, hey, I hear you, you're on television. I'm like, yeah. I just left my mom's room. He goes, so what are you doing? You know, what is it? I go, I really don't want to talk about this.
No, good time.
And he goes, okay, I don't give a damn about your fucking show. And walked off, and I just...
like, I'm at the hospital.
I got so enraged. I walked over to him. I go, why are you here? And he looks at me, you know, because I can get pretty...
Yeah.
Why are you here? And he's like, my wife's in there dying. And I'm like, my mom's in there dying. You got to understand, sir, that show business is the least important thing on my mind right now.
Mm.
And he started crying, and I started crying. I kind of took his hand and just said, okay, you know, some other time, man. And I walked back, and I thought I handled it okay.
That's amazing. No, I think that's amazing, because what you did is you explained to him, you educated him at that moment. What more can you do to another human but be like, I know things seem like this, and you're angry that your wife is dying, and you think I'm an asshole actor who doesn't care, but actually I'm a human, and we're both humans right now.
I can't process. Spewing out my fucking resume right now.
Yeah. I think that's a really... And you didn't you didn't whack him across the face, take him to the window. Like, that's maturity.
That's a step forward.
Yeah, it is. That's the difference between adults and kids, that you were able to go, I want to throw you out a window, but what I'm going to do is go, hey... You're being an asshole, and I know you don't mean to. This is why. I think that's that attitude is, golden. Like, that's what we all need right now. Rather than being like, you're wrong.
Oh, you do. I mean, I'm always about, because I know the opposite. I mean, I know the opposite of the anger and all that kind of stuff, it can do. It, and I still suffer from it.
Mm.
I mean, people suffer from me doing it, really. Because I should be conscious at this point of it. I can get really, you know, about stuff.
Oh, same. I steam. When you're someone who has anger, you know its power. Yeah. You know how you know that if you use it, you can get what you want quite easily sometimes. You know, like, it's like tempting, isn't it? Like a drug. It's like, well, if I kick off really badly, everyone will let me do what I want to do. And it's like, you know, you have to kind of that's the maturity, isn't it? Of going, I'm not going to do what I used to do, which is just throw my toys out the pram and shout. I'm going to have to reason and be fair. And but yeah, it's hard.
And if negotiate.
Yeah. Because some people can't get angry. Like they just don't know. It's not in their nature. But if you have it in your nature, it's like having a massive sword. It's like you have to know when to use it and use it for good and all of that stuff. But I think learning that is a process of, stabbing people
lots
with a big sword.
Lots of peaks and valleys in your life.
Yes,
yeah.
Lots of like times when you're holding the giant sword going, oh, did I? I did, didn't I? I got the giant sword. Everyone's really upset with me. Oh, dear. Yeah. And like you said, with anger, often it is afterwards, isn't it? It's like you and then you look at their faces and you're like, oh I got angry. Oh, because it just happens so fast. And that's how I judge now, is I have to watch people's faces quite closely to be like,
I do too.
Yeah, to be like, oh, I'm, because I don't know I'm shouting. So sometimes people, the face is telling me, and I'm like, am I being, and Ben, my husband, would be like, you're being really aggressive, right? And I'm like, oh, I thought I was being really just like chirpy.
Emphatic and
yeah, passionate.
To be,
yeah. Yeah. The anger. No. Yeah,
the person's like.
Yeah, yeah. And you're like, no, I'm just really saying that's what I think. I don't know why everyone is scared. Like, yeah, yeah. It's hard to know your own volume, I guess, isn't it? Yeah.
It is. I think the shell, the candy shell that we each come in,
yeah.
I think that's what got me in trouble because I was big. If you look at my Facebook account, there's a picture of me. You ever seen with the hair?
Oh, yeah, yeah,
like,
yeah.
That's, imagine me looking like that.
Yeah, yeah.
A huge, long, big, you know, I think I frightened people.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Because I was hippie. You know, hippie meant Charles Manson, meant LSD. Yeah, you know, yeah. Meant me, that image made people go, oh, my God, in Kansas. So. You know, there's a little of that. So when Mom was in the hospital, we went home.
So she came home with you?
No.
So you and
they
your dad.
We were exhausted. My dad was exhausted, you know. And we said, let's go home for the, you know, we were there till like 10 p.m. And then she died in the night. Got the call around 3:30.
Wow.
She'd gone. So I drove him back over and she was gone. And that's the first time I ever saw my dad weep, you know. And he pulled out the Shakespeare. You know, he loved, he said, I love you, I love you. And flights of angels sing you to your rest. And I was like, you know, because my dad didn't read Shakespeare.
Yeah.
That kind of guy. He's a postman, you know, an educated man, but a postman. And not given to, you know, generalized Irish, like, oh, I have a quote for everything. Kind of
yeah.
Guy, and just he wept and shuddered. And I held him, and or held alongside of him. He had a moment with her, and then I went in. And talked to her, and her teeth had been, you know, she had false teeth. I put her teeth in her mouth, and I couldn't get them in exactly. So every time it fit, it'd be like
slightly lopsided.
Like Bugs Bunny. And I started laughing. I just started fucking laughing. And it was going between feeling really, really awful and feeling really happy that she's free.
Yeah.
You know? But I wasn't mocking.
No, of course not. It's just one of those moments.
Mortality is so fucking stupid and disrespectful to what we think we are.
Yeah.
That you gotta laugh at it sometimes. Yeah, yeah. And my mother's catchphrase always in my life was, honey, you might as well laugh. You know? And so we went to bury her. Now, she was raised Methodist in this big family with all these sisters. And the only two sisters who moved to the city were my mother, Ruby, and Aunt Marjorie. My Aunt Marjorie was a huge, tall woman who took some gene pool from the Amazonian ball busters of some family in Kansas. She was awful. She was my babysitter when I was a kid.
Wow.
She was a no-nonsense woman. You know Mary Wicks, the character actress? You ever watch... Sister acts. What none that talks like
that's
Mary Wicks. She's she's a big, tall, wide hip, no nonsense.
Yes, don't mess with.
Don't mess with. And she was just the biggest pain in the ass in my life. My dad was a mailman. He'd come home from work. We eat at 3:30 every day. Every day. She would call at 3:20 every day. And I go, hello, Aunt Marjorie. Oh, you know, it's me. Yeah.
Yeah.
Is Ruby there? Yeah. It might bother you. No, I'm not. You know. I'm go over. So I hit 15, 16, you know, your big truth teller.
Is he?
Yeah, Mom's here. Am I bothering? Yeah. Why do you call? Every time my mom and dad, Jesus, you know, my dad. Just like, my mom's like, oh, no, no, no.
Don't tell her, don't
like,
tell
my
her.
My mom would smoke and eat. She'd be like, oh, yeah. With the cigarette and like walk over and go, boy, hi, you know. And
no, ignore him, ignore him.
Oh, I inherited a dog for a while named Scotty. He was a Manchester Toy Terrier. It was a great dog. Talked to him all the time. One of his attributes, he was hump crazy. Dog was hump crazy.
Right, yeah.
And we kept him outside. But when my Aunt Margie would come over, my dad hated her so much. At one point, he'd be going, get the dog. And my Aunt Margie had big, big calves, which are like Valhalla for this dog.
Scotty was like, oh.
I imagine, like,
thank you, Mike. Thank you.
Just wham, would go right on him. And she, lad's sake, God told you to get that dog, a damn filthy animal. And we're like, you know, my dad would go, Mike, I told you. Boy, get that dog out. He'd look at me and go, good job. Kind of thing as a guy does, you know.
That's and so then, funny.
So I mentioned her because.
So she was still alive when Ruby died?
When Ruby died.
Right.
At this point, she had sort of fourth divorce.
So did you have to call Aunt Marjorie and tell her about what happened?
We called her, and we called the rest of the family. And so we had a Catholic funeral, open casket. It snowed really, really bad, really terrible snow. So some of the people from the northern counties couldn't make it down. My Uncle Dale, my Aunt Gwendolyn. Some of the kids made it down because they were from further, like Topeka. My Aunt Marjorie, who really was only about 12 miles away, took forever. Now, at this time, she's also in a wheelchair.
Yeah.
Withered left eye and a cane. Wow. God's truth. Call her One-Eyed Margie. That's what my dad used to call her, One-Eyed Margie then. So we're at the open casket funeral. You can hear this, my dad's church, St. Agnes, my church I grew up in. We're taking, finally, okay, well, you know, not everybody's going to make it. We wheeled it out. We're going to put it in the hearse. This is God's truth, Carrie Ann. The doors on the church go boom, with the snow coming in, and Margie's being wheeled in by Dale, and she's got her stick and her fucking one eye, and he wheels up, and like fucking Richard III takes her stick and goes whack, and stops the progress of my mother's coffin.
Oh my God.
And we're just like,
what?
Totally what? Totally just like, and then, you know, like gestures like brusquely to like, you know, lift up the lid. Not even talking, like, eh. Hikes herself up halfway out of the chair and looks at her. Flops back in the chair. Close the lid, wheels and splits.
What? So she just...
Karen was there. Because I used to have to go, did I imagine that? Did I just imagine that? And Karen was like, no.
She just wheeled herself in, stopped the coffin, looks it, checks, yep, she's in there, she's dead. And then just left.
Fucks off.
It's like something from a film.
It was. I swear to God. You know, August Osage County, fuck, please. Please.
I've lived it, baby. Yeah. Oh, my God. Did you see her again?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, my dad, not the good thing. I thought, you know, because my dad was a caretaker to her.
He,
you know, my dad had a lot of faith, very Catholic faith.
Yeah.
And, he had a second adolescence.
Wow.
Not a childhood.
After she died?
But yeah, he would just, you know, because my dad was a really good-looking guy.
Wow.
My dad, you know, when I was a kid, you know, he looked like Mel Gibson.
Did he kind of start?
He started...
hanging out? And
no, he just started after that. Well, he did. He's flirty. He's naturally... He's Irish, you know. Usually he's Irish-American. We'd go to the mall during the winter so he could walk, and he had a baseball cap. Tilted. He had this little tilt. And he'd see some young 75-year-olds.
Yeah,
you know? Yeah. And he'd go, 1 second, son. He'd literally get in front of the mirror and pimp it up, like tilt it, and do like the stroll. It's like a Midwestern pimp stroll, I guess. Well, morning, ladies. And, you know, he was charming. My dad was a charming guy.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was like, damn, you know, rock on, Dad.
Well, yeah.
You know? He gave me all my shots, and they both gave me my shots and gave it to me. So, yeah, and he lived to be 96 and was compost menace till the end.
Wow.
Being adopted, it's really weird. I don't know, you know, nobody has a primacy on how much you love your parents.
Mm.
But I don't often wonder if when you're adopted, you love them with a weird sort of intensity. My dad lived for so long, I thought he would live forever.
Mm.
So then when he died, and, you know, obviously, tragically happened to you, my dad was taken from me late in life, and I still feel this day, both of them, that I lost some magic.
Yeah.
And it's funny, I take that to Phil with the play I'm doing, Huey, telling you that when somebody really matters to you and they're gone, you feel something's gone. I,
Yeah.
I'm not going to get this thing back.
Yeah.
You know, this presence in your eyes or mind, your eyes, your mind, or your heart. And I still think about them. And I really mourn my mother because the disease ate her up and she was a sparkly woman. Later on in life, my dad, the advantage of my dad living longer was occasionally we went to a museum in Cloud County in Concordia. Mm-hmm. That's the county that Concordia is in, God Street, Cloud County. And it's a big, long, it's a big farmer's hall. So it's got tractors and shit. And we're walking around because every once we'd go and look at the what's left of the prisoner war camp because the stories my dad would tell me. And so went to the museum, and I'm looking around. All of a sudden, I look down the hall. My dad's standing really weird. His arms are, like, faced out. His body's, and I was like, is he okay? And I walk towards him. He's looking at this biplane, small biplane, crop duster, which is hanging from the wires on there. The engine's out.
Yeah.
I go, what? He goes, your mom used to ride in this with this guy, Larry. She used to sit in the back as he would do crop dusting. And I go, yeah, that makes sense. She was adventuresome.
Yeah.
Other story told me later in life. She would go out at night and by herself. And she'd come back like all sweaty and shit. My dad didn't question it. But he was like, he got jealous. He's like, what's going on? He didn't trust her. He's shamed. He says, yeah, I say it's a shame. He goes, so I followed her one night. And she went to the stables. And she took out a horse bareback in the moonlight and would ride the horse bareback.
Wow.
In the moon.
That's an amazing image of somebody.
It's funny. When I was in California, I got out of the army. I lived in a commune. And it was crazy. And it was near a big field, a big cornfield. And one night, it was a full moon. And there's this dog there. It wasn't my dog. I didn't even see it before. But it's kind of a dangerous-looking dog. It wasn't acting just like a pit bull. It was thick. It was just all like, you know, and I just, I was pent up with something. I started running up and down the rows of the cornfield. And this dog ran with me all night. I ran for like an hour. And this dog just ran with me through the field, like romping and looking at me. And I kind of later thought about my mom, thinking that's in that broad light where you're just one human being and you're ripping through the world, you know. How good it feels.
Mm.
And so what hurts me is in my mind is, you know, oh, this vital woman. I got this great care from her, but the sparkle in her, you know, got ripped away. And sometimes I feel, because of that, I feel women get short shrift. And I admire that. You know, even when I was sick, I had pneumonia when I was a kid. And, they had to put me in a bathtub of ice. And I remember being, like, passed out in my bedroom and hearing all my mom's sisters talking and the sound of women laughing and chatting as sisters. I have pictures, you know, my mom and Aunt Marjorie didn't get along, but they were sisters. There's shots of them sitting around laughing it up. And that's, I always favor that in my memory.
Yeah. But it
Excuse
sounds,
me.
No, it's fine. It just sounds like... I think what you're talking about, what's sometimes hard to get your head around, is like it's such a different world, isn't it? Like, you know, when you talk about like born in 1910, 1912, like, you know, diphtheria epidemics and the birth of, you know, pharmacology and all of like, it is such a different,
yeah.
It's a different planet. It's a different
it's
planet.
It's a very different planet.
And so for what they grew up in, and like you said, then... What she sounds, it's difficult, isn't it? Because she sounds like she was a real country girl.
She
like,
was a country girl.
Yeah. And then this other sort of new world came in, and as ever, probably saved her life several times, as medicine does, but also caused other problems. And this way that the world moves very fast sometimes. And
she did. See, both my parents grew up in that greatest generation thing. The world moved very quick from the rural to the city.
Yeah.
Hence, in that time, in the 60s and 70s, a lot of the comedies were the Beverly Hillbillies, Green Acres.
Yeah.
It was about, and those came off of an original play called The Egg and I, about a city dweller that goes to the country to get back to his roots.
Yeah,
and he meets this couple called Ma and Pa Kettle. And we're in movies with these two
characters.
Kind of famous. So that really was a marking of these advancement of that.
It's shifting,
becoming the middle class. So only two people from my mom's family did that. Airbell stayed in Belleville and Scandia. So my mom was.
Yeah.
And my Aunt Marjorie were quite adventuresome women.
Yeah, to do that at that time.
You know, so I'm much props to them. That's why I look at it. Even Aunt Marjorie. My dad, we'd go to visit her. And by the time she was really old, she lived in kind of a luxury apartment in Kansas City. And my dad would make me sit facing her and making small talk while my dad would sit on her blind side. And literally, I swear to God, Carrie, she'd be talking and be looking at her going...
Just doing faces on her blind side. I guess if you've known someone that long and they've been driving you crazy that long, you're like, I'm going to fucking do it. I'm going to enjoy this eye situation. I am 90 and I've been put up with this shit for a long time.
That was my dad. But that's my daddy. My dad was always like, you know, he was a kind of crazy guy that way, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. So, but it's interesting because, like you say.
But he respected the family enough to go and visit her still.
Yeah. And you. I just think it's interesting because she sounds like you said she was actually very adventurous and sparky, but also that's interesting that, you know, you did. You then left Kansas and went into the commune like that. That was actually very adventurous for the time. You could have stayed in Kansas, stayed in the army, you know, followed the line that they wanted you to. And I think it's funny sometimes, like, even though you said you're adopted, there is that similarity there of
I believe high percentage of nurture.
Yeah, she must have put that in of like, you go and you find it. Even if she was worried for you and all of that stuff. Yeah. How do you feel about, like, so 97, where are you up to now? You're coming up to, well, my dad's 98, so yeah, you've hit, like, past 20 years. Mm-hmm. How's that anniversary for you? Do you still remember it, or do you feel like it's past, or?
I think I've mourned her. I'm still sad about the missed opportunities in her life. I still have residual, not heavy, the sort of regret that I couldn't have seen her clearer.
Mm.
And been appreciative, truly, not obsequiously and appreciative of them, but just take them because I got to do that with my dad.
Yeah, yeah.
The time allowed me to have that with
them,
what I didn't have. I mean, she got to see me be on TV.
Yeah.
She got to see me be in Robin Hood.
That's very cool. You know, she must have thought that was cool.
Yeah, I mean, I got off the plane, I took a cab into the house, and I got in the house, and they were both sitting at a table. With a box of cereal, Prince of Thieves cereal, with bowls of cereal. They're clowny. They're like, like that, you know.
That's so sweet.
And, yeah, and so that was sweet. And he goes, I bought five. I go, Dad, you don't need to buy five boxes of this shit. And it'll last. I go, it'll last until Armageddon, Dad. He goes, it's pretty crappy stuff. Yeah. I go, it really is.
Yeah, that's okay. Oh, that's so sweet.
So, yeah, they got to see me succeed.
Yeah, yeah.
And they were responsible for my success. They floated me when I was broke.
Yeah, yeah. But it's funny in a way because I think, I don't know, like until you lose a parent, it's really hard to know. And maybe this isn't fair, I don't know. But I do think losing a parent really, like you said, allows you to see them clearly. And I think it's actually quite hard to see them clearly.
They get filled in by the surviving parents.
Yeah, exactly.
Did you know they did this? Or did your mom do that with your dad?
Yeah, yeah. Oh my God, yeah. The stories of the shenanigans that they got up to, which... Yeah, you know, you start painting this picture and you start going, oh, they were really people before I arrived.
Before I met them.
And you don't know that when you're a kid. You don't appreciate it. And I think sometimes things have to go before. You don't know what you've got till it's gone, as Joni said.
That's it.
And I think also what sounds really lovely is that enabled you and your dad to have a really great relationship because you were able to go,
yeah,
I know what I need. I can see it and I can say it. And it sounds like you guys had a really... like really strong, beautiful relationship after
we
that.
We actually really did.
Yeah, which is lucky, you know, like you not know, everybody
got to
gets
to Ireland and walk around Dublin. Wow. He was 90, you know.
Wow. But it must have been amazing to take him to Dublin. And like you said, it sounds like you had all these experiences that your mum's death, obviously you didn't want it to happen, but the consequence of that was this great relationship with your dad.
I didn't know about the accident with the killing, my would have been my aunt dying. I thought that was just later. I thought, oh, she got ill. But that my Uncle Doc, who I remember, who was the tail, he had a really nice house in Manhattan, Kansas. We always went there for Christmas, wood paneled, you know. And he was the kind of guy like, Father, Son, the Holy Ghost, who eats the fastest, gets the most, dig in. He was that kind of thing, you know.
Yeah.
And he was, because I had one cousin the same age. Then I found out he was writing prescriptions for like speed for the war effort for the guys could work in the munitions longer, and they got addicted and they broke into his office. And my Aunt Rosalind, who was a devout Methodist, had to go to the houses and get money for the drugs that they were addicted to. Holy shit. I didn't know anything. Like, so this one, like two nights in Ireland, with my dad at the Hotel Gresham. We were snowed in. You couldn't leave. So we had two stuck days. We just had out this. And simultaneously, there was an outbreak of hoof and mouth disease in the UK. So we were stuck in a snowed-in hotel room. And the only thing on the TV were huge pyres of burning livestock.
Yeah, I remember.
And I thought, remember? And I thought, God, this is like hell.
Well, this is it. This is actual hell. Yeah. Thank you so much for coming to talk to me about Ruby. She sounds like a real character.
She did have a middle name. That's that always chews me off. Everyone's got Hester and Thyra. One of the sisters named Thyra.
I'm like, why did they just gave up? They were like, but Ruby's such a good name. And they were like, it's enough.
It's a great time when women were named after jewels.
Yeah, yeah. And what was your dad's name?
My dad was Kenneth John McShane.
Kenneth, you're so.
Kenny or Mac. His name was Mac.
Thank you so much for coming to talk to me about Ruby.
Thank you for letting me talk about my mom and dad.
You can follow Mike on Twitter at this Mike McShane, M-I-K-E. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at The Griefcast. The show was edited by Kate Holland, with thanks to Whistledown Studios, and the music was provided by the Glue Ensemble. And remember, you are not alone.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.